Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today on the show, I've got a very special discussion about the new film, God's Country, starring Tondiwe Newton. My guest today is the film's director, Julian Higgins, who was so kind to agree to come on the show and break down his film with us. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with him, and I know you'll love it too. Stick around. Before we get into the show, don't forget Art House Garage has a Patreon. Sign up today for extended episodes, bonus episodes, video episodes, and ad-free episodes. All that, plus a discount on merch in the Art House Garage shop. Go to patreon.com/arthousegarage today, or find a link in the show notes. Okay, back to the show. Welcome to Art House Garage. Earlier this year, I was thrilled to attend the Bentonville Film Festival. You can go back and listen to episode 86 to hear my full reaction to the festival experience and the films I saw there. But one of my favorite films at Bentonville was today's film, God's Country. It's a gorgeous neo-western starring Tondiwe Newton. Newton plays a college professor who lives in rural Montana. One morning, two hunters park on her property, and she lets them know that she doesn't want them to park there. That innocuous beginning gradually escalates in a story filled with tension and surprises, in addition to timely ideas about how divided the U.S. has become and the historical legacies each of us come from. When I first saw the film at Bentonville, it was followed by a Q&A with the film's director, Julian Higgins. He spoke all about how the film came to be and his methods as a screenwriter and a director. It was fascinating to hear. After the Q&A, I was able to hang back and catch a few minutes with Julian and asked if he'd be willing to come on the podcast. And obviously he said yes, and you're about to hear our discussion about this film. Before we get into that, I want to encourage you to seek out God's Country in theaters. It is playing now as of this podcast release on Monday, September 19th. And if you live in central Arkansas, like I do, and like many of my listeners do, God's Country is playing in Little Rock. I wasn't sure we would get it since it's just a limited release, but it is playing now at the Cinemark Colonel Glenn, aka The Rave. It's not technically called The Rave anymore, but I think that's what everyone still calls it. But you can catch it on the big screen there. And I recommend that you do. The cinematography looks gorgeous on a big screen, and is the kind of thriller that would be really fun to experience with a crowd. So now let's get into my talk with Julian. This film is based on a short story called Winter Light by a writer named James Lee Burke. Before he made God's Country, Julian also directed a short film based on the story. You'll hear more about that in our discussion, but I wanted to let you know that you can read the short story online for free on James Lee Burke's website, and I have linked to that in the show notes so you can check it out. And one final note, I had to talk to Julian about the film's ending, so we do get into spoilers about three-fourths of the way through the episode. There is a spoiler warning before we do, so go ahead and listen now and just tune out when you hear that. Okay, now, first, here is the trailer for God's Country, followed directly by my discussion with the film's director, Julian Higgins.
Did you see a red truck this morning in the canyon? It was parked in my driveway.
Probably hunters, right?
I don't know.
I heard about you. Just didn't know it was this canyon.
Did they threaten you at all?
Not overtly, but I have definitely been made to feel threatened.
Where are you from originally?
New Orleans. I teach at the university.
Out here, things are a little different. Most folks, they handle this sort of thing amongst themselves.
I guess I'm not most folks.
Should we call for backup?
What backup? We've got two officers to cover 300 square miles.
I don't feel safe in my own house.
There isn't enough law in this whole state to make you feel safe.
Behind you.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Everybody step forward, you put your saws down, you take your masks off.
A what?
I wanted to ask you something.
If I tell you, you have to promise you won't say anything.
Tell me what? These guys keep coming back. Why do you think that is?
Why do you care so much? Go back to sleep.
Why don't you come inside? We can work it out. What's the matter? Hey, where are you going?
I wonder sometimes how much you choose to be the person you are.
We're here!
Sometimes it feels like things never change. But I promise you, they do. They have to.
Julian Higgins, thanks so much for joining the show today. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited to talk to you. So I had the great pleasure of seeing God's Country earlier this year at the Bentonville Film Festival. And then I met you there after the Q&A. Afterwards, I think you called it, the word you used was that it was a juicy Q&A. And I think that was the case. I really enjoyed it as well. Wanted to get some of those same thoughts, and I had more questions too. Let's just do the
podcast. Yeah, I can't wait. And that was a very juicy Q&A. I was all fired up. I think I had arrived shortly before that Q&A.
Oh, nice.
So I was full of adrenaline.
That's great. Well, it was funny. I was thinking about my experience of watching it there because I didn't know much about the film going in, which is the fun thing about film festivals. But I had just seen a bunch of documentaries and stuff. And I was like, you know what? I want to do a narrative and I have a slot right here. And I knew, you know, Sundance had happened and God's Country had played there. It's like, oh yeah, Tantivy Newton has some kind of buzzy movie, but I did not make the connection that it was the same thing. So when Tantivy was on the screen, I was like, oh, this is that movie. This is that Sundance one. So excited. That was an exciting moment for me realizing, oh, this is a movie I've been wanting to watch anyway. So yes.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have a, we got acquired out of Sundance by IFC and we didn't have hugely long window to do festivals. So I was very happy to get to go to a few festivals and actually engage with people in person. And then you and I had a great conversation afterwards. So that was nice too.
Yeah. And it was a kind of thing where I was like, okay, I have other questions, but we'll save it for the podcast. And so now we're finally here.
And here we are.
Yeah. Well, when I think about the experience of watching God's Country, what I remember the most is the tone of it and kind of the tension of it. And it's kind of propulsive, feels like it's leading up to something. So my first, I guess, general question is, how did you achieve the tone? How did you think about that as you were creating it? And was there anything, films or filmmakers, that influenced you as you were developing the story?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question to start with, because it's actually, tone is one of the more complicated things to talk about, I think, because I am not entirely convinced that tone is a conscious decision. I think it's a confluence of a lot of different things that happen during the making of a movie. And like, I usually have this experience where I'll be trying to kind of like break out of kind of how I've seen my work in the previous stuff that I've done. And I'll be trying to do something different, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can't ever tell if I'm doing something different because it ends up just being sort of the way I think it should go. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously there's a lot of collaboration, a lot of ideas that come in from elsewhere, but they're all sort of filtered through this feeling. I kind of, for me, the feeling of it is the part that I'm chasing. Like there's something that made me want to make the movie, and usually it's emotional and not intellectual. Yeah. And for me, a big part of getting into this film was a sense of anger. And like I felt, and Shay Obana, my writing partner on this, like we worked for so long on this script, and it was coming from a place of kind of outrage on our part and just sadness and anger. Those were the feelings that motivated us to do it, that we were trying to explore. And I think ultimately the choices that you make about like where to put the camera, the color palette, like the locations you choose, it's all hopefully traceable back to it's kind of like the translation of those feelings, mm. you know, like, you know, that's the journey of trying to turn a story into a movie, is to try to translate something that's written into something that's visual, primarily visual. Mm-hmm. And so the camera throughout is doing all kinds of things that are really about the feelings we're trying to evoke. So that's really the question for all, like, you know, whenever my cinematographer, for example, like Andrew Wheeler, the cinematographer I've been working with for over a decade now, usually when we're stumped on how to shoot something, he will just ask me, what do you want the audience to feel? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the question that it always boils down to. And I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about tone, you know, is trying to curate an experience for the audience where they are feeling and thinking about the things you hope they're going to be feeling and thinking about.
Yeah.
I think as an audience member, I really like that. I like when I feel like the film is taking really good care of me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like they're not talking down to me. They think I'm smart. They think I'm an emotional person. They want to kind of curate this feast for me. I love being taken care of by a movie in that way. So that's what we're thinking of when we're thinking about tone. I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, I think that's great. And I was going to say it as you were talking about that, you know, not talking down to you, because that's the thing. It's like you want the movie to kind of guide you into some emotions or ideas, but you don't want it to control you and explain how you should feel about something, or like, yeah. like be manipulative or whatever. And I wonder if that's a balancing act, but I think that God's Country did that for me, at least. To
oh well, that's great. I mean, the dividing line for me when I watch movies is there's like two things that it feels like are really the fundamental dividing lines. One is, does the film love the characters in the film? Because there's a kind of a thrust in, especially American movies, I feel right now, where it's almost like they want the audience to stand outside the film and kind of almost laugh at the characters or like regard them as not, yeah, I don't know. We're just kind of watching something from afar. And I really love when a movie, when the filmmakers and the movie itself clearly cares about the characters, you know, that's a huge thing for me. And then the other thing is, do you think the audience is smart? Like philosophically, is the movie regarding the audience as like intelligent? And, you know, a lot of times when I shut stuff off, it's because I feel like the movie thinks I'm dumb, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I just don't want to be talked to that way. So I just can't stick with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, I think again, I do feel like this film, it's pulling you along towards some sort of conclusion, but yeah, there's so many different ideas and stuff that I want to ask about in a minute. First I was going to ask about the lead performance. So we have Tondiwe Newton here as a fantastic lead. How did she get involved in the film? Did you think of her in particular as you were writing it, or how did that process go?
We absolutely thought of her, but I have to tell you that, you know, this is my first feature. It was conceived and expected to be a very low budget movie. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like early on, something that happens is like, you know, if you have lucky to have a casting director, they will send a long list of name actors that could do the roles, you know, just to kind of get your brain firing. But like, you know, it's a really difficult role to cast. And without giving too much away, like you just have to believe that you have to believe a lot of things about the character at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a certain like grit and toughness and strength to the character. And then there's also like a very human sort of delicate emotional quality to the character as well. Like we have very privileged access to this character in the movie. The whole thing was about trying to bring the audience really like with her on the journey and not be outside of it looking at her, but like really allowing the audience to experience what it's like to be her, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have to believe all these very sometimes contradictory things about her, you know? Like, so it was a very difficult role to cast. And when you're making a tiny movie, you don't expect to get a movie star. and frankly, what happened was we had started to audition people for that role. And you know, essentially what happened was when you audition, when you hold auditions, the breakdown goes out with a character description, and one thing led to another, and she actually identified the movie and reached out to us.
Wow.
And she, it was very clear to me when I talked to her that she really identified with it. Mm-hmm. And really, like, she told me she wanted to be the person who told this story, you know.
Wow.
And you know, I think when, I mean, obviously it's like, of course we would love to have Tandy Wei Newton in our movie, but it's like, I just kind of don't really feel like that happens unless there's a real deep connection there, you know. Yeah. Like nobody did this movie for the money, you know, that's for sure. It was a very small movie, so the only reason people were doing it was because they actually thought it was a worthwhile project, which I take a lot of you know, comfort in.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't love when people treat things as gigs, you know.
Right.
I want to encourage and create an environment where people are really investing in what we're doing and becoming passionate about it. And she had that from the very beginning. So it's just kind of one of those things where we just kind of said yes to the incredible things that were happening.
Yeah, what an endorsement of your screenplay that she wanted. She reached out to you about it. That's incredible, because I can imagine you're like, okay, I hope this is good. I hope people connect with it. And then, oh, tell you.
Well, yeah, and part of what we were trying to do, too, was, I mean, Shay and I, when we started working on the project in 2017, you know, we basically were looking around, like, everyone was sort of talking about how important, you know, I mean, they still are. I mean, representation and creating different kinds of roles and like giving people opportunities that they richly deserve but have not been able to have access to. And like, you know, we wanted to try to do our best to write an incredibly complex and three-dimensional lead role for a Black woman in her 40s, you know. Like, we want that was not a character that we were seeing anywhere. And, you know, Shay has spoken about this very eloquently in other places, but like, you know, his sort of motivation and like his sort of guiding light in being a screenwriter is to kind of place, like, honor his mother and the women who raised him in genre storytelling, where he never sees that kind of character. Mm-hmm. So like, we were very invested in trying to create a really juicy role, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so we hoped that if we did the thing that people were saying they wanted to see, that we would be able to attract someone who was really perfect for it. And it seems like that's exactly what happened. Yeah. Because we genuinely can't, we never have, and I never will be able to think of anyone that I would rather have in this role than Tandy Wei.
Well, that's amazing. And that actually leads to my next question too, is, so you based this film on a short story by James Lee Burke, and you first directed a short film based on that short story that's a bit more close to kind of the character details and that sort of thing, and then expanded that into God's Country with a lot of changes, which I want to talk about. But you also have a co-writer here, Shay Ogbonna. How did you meet Shay, and at what point did you say, I want to write this with somebody else, and how did that process go?
Yeah, the story of turning this short story into a feature is quite long and complicated. As you said, I read this short story, Winter Light, James Lee Burke's short story, in 2010. That was in December of 2010 was the first time I read that story. And it was one of those things where, like, I read it and I knew that there was something there for me that, like, I had to deal with. Like, it was calling to me for reasons that I didn't initially understand. And, you know, I can, you know, there was a whole process of turning that into a short film a few years later. But essentially, the short story is so contained, and it's very abrupt. Like, it's actually available now. You can read it online on the James Lee Burke website.
Okay, I checked it out from my local library and read it this week
too. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's an interesting. if you do see the movie, it's fascinating to then go read the short story, I think, because it is a very radical adaptation of it.
Yeah.
Yet I think it is trying to capture a lot of the same. The essence is absolutely there. It's just it's an interesting adaptation. But anyway, the short film, I really never considered that it would become a feature. I was arguing throughout the whole thing because it was kind of an expensive short, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, anyway, the point is that people were saying like, well, maybe we should make this into a feature. Like, we have to raise all this money. But I just didn't see how it could be a feature, you know? It felt perfect for a short film. And so basically we made the short and I just kind of figured that would be the end of it. Mm-hmm. And then a few years went by. And in right after the election in 2016, that old thing, I was driving home from Whole Foods in like December of, or actually it was January of 2017. And the story just popped into my head in the context of like this new era in American history that we were clearly entering. And the themes of the story kind of came back to me in a new way. And I just kind of had this idea, like, you know, it seemed like it could be a simple framework for a story that could really tackle a lot of these really major dynamics in our society that we deal with, we all are subject to all the time. And I had this idea that by changing the nature of the main character, who in the story is a, you know, retired white guy, changing the nature of that character to, initially the thought was like a black man. But then once I started working with Shay, we decided a black woman would be even more a fascinating lens for the story. That we'd basically be able to tap into all of these dynamics because, you know, we were trying to make an intersectional film that really like doesn't try to talk about race or gender or whatever in a vacuum, but actually tries to get at all of these things together and how they kind of play out in the lives of all people. So that was the genesis of it. And then Shay and I, of course, like that's a huge responsibility and a huge kind of chunk of ideas to tackle. So we really spent a very long time working on the script before we ever even showed it to anybody. To try to get it made. I mean,
yeah,
we were getting feedback on it throughout, but you know, we really didn't want to start trying to make the script into a film before we felt really, really confident in what we had written.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask about the choice of changing that protagonist, which you just answered so beautifully. But it gives such a different, after reading the story and then watching the film, it gives such a different feeling to so many of the scenes, even that are from the original story. So like her relationship with Gretchen feels very different.
Yeah.
Interactions with the hunters is so different. When he says, "I've heard about you," that feels very different when it's two white guys saying that to a black woman. You know,
absolutely. I mean, that line, "I heard about you," was the line that popped into my head as I was driving home from Whole Foods that day, because I at the moment that I had the idea of changing the character, you know, the moment Roger in the story becomes Sandra in our film, the subtext and the meaning and the underlying mythologies and archetypes of the story completely change. And that was what was exciting, because it suddenly allows us to access all these themes and feelings and dynamics that we wanted to explore. But the line that I heard was the hunter saying, "I heard about you," because that is the perfect example of the meaning of that completely changes. The short story is about a kind of generational divide between men. It's really about masculinity primarily. And it's about the challenge to this older man's masculinity when these younger guys try to like, you know, piss on his turf, basically. but when it becomes a black woman, suddenly there are so many things that are playing into that little scenario. And that to me felt very, it sort of exemplified a lot of the things that we're feeling these days, that like everything is so loaded now. And it's because I believe we refuse to be honest about our own history. You know, that's really like what that's where Shay and I eventually landed. We arrived there we perpetuate these cycles because we refuse to be honest about our history, both as people and as a nation. And, you know, that's why we've sort of alluded to history throughout the story. Like there's just, the idea that we're sort of trapped in these cycles that are bad for everyone, and asking, like, is it possible for us to break out of those cycles?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that opening scene where we see like a classroom and there's these historical photos going, and it's eerie because it's this empty room and you don't quite understand why, and just this photo projector going with these historical images. So immediately you're thinking about the things before us. And then later there's a great conversation, which I don't want to spoil, but a conversation that happens with the Nathan character about that, and they directly reckon with
that's
before us or whatever. Yeah,
sorry I was talking over you. I'm so excited to chat about this stuff. That you're really putting your finger on a lot of the things that just got us the most motivated to tell the story, because like for me what was so fascinating, and I've kind of dealt with these things independently in things that I've done before, but this is the first time I feel like they've really come along jointly, is a kind of mirroring and like commentary back and forth, like a dialectic between our historical story and anybody's personal story, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that like Sandra's own psychological experience as a human being in her life is so affected by the history of the country that she had nothing to do with, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the case for all of us. And, we wanted to basically try to make a story where the challenges of being human, no matter which character you're talking about, are in this context that is bigger than everyone, you know, and have the audience think about both at the same time.
Yeah. And that's, so actually I was going to ask about, you know, with a feature runtime, you're able to flesh out these characters so much, and there's characters that don't appear in the story, show up in the film, some new characters. But I think the one that was the most interesting for me was the character of Nathan, who's sort of the primary hunter, the older brother, I think, of the two of them. And we really get to know him more, and it's talking about the 2016 election. When I first saw the film, you know, they drive up in this red truck, and I was thinking the color red is kind of a little more loaded, thinking about like MAGA hats and that kind of stuff. But then it doesn't. I expected it to be a little more, ham-fisted commentary or something. But and then reading the story, the red truck was there from the beginning. So there's that. But then, was it challenging to expand his role? From the story, he's just kind of a menacing presence, but we really get to know him. We see his day job, and that's when you first see him in that setting. It's so startling. It's such a difference from what we've seen with him, and then seeing him later in different settings too. How did you flesh that character out? What was that process like?
Well, first of all, thanks for what such a careful engagement with all these things. The story, the film, I mean, it's really awesome to engage with you about this.
Thanks.
Basically one of the things that I was not, you know, I have a complex relationship with the short film that I made of this story. One of the things that I felt was a bit disappointing about it for me was that I wasn't able to render the so-called bad guy characters, these two hunters, as complex human beings, really. Like at the end of the day, they are sort of like the black hats, you know. And I think it's also not, it doesn't support the motivations that we had in telling the story to, you know, make them just villains, you know. I mean, everybody in the movie has to be seen by the audience as a three-dimensional human being as much as we can manage, because then it becomes more challenging, you know, you have to think more about it. And we really made the movie to try to challenge the audience out of their comfortable understandings of where they sit in this very polarized media consuming environment that we live in. Everyone's looking for those little indicators that are going to tell them what they're supposed to think, where they're supposed to align in relation to something. I mean, sometimes I read log lines for a movie and I already know what they're trying to tell me, and I don't even feel like I need to see it, you know? So Shay and I were really trying to like remove those indicators so that the audience would really have to kind of really consider what this all means in a different way than if it was easy to like identify, okay, those are the bad guys, these are the good guys, you know. And at the same time, while that's all happening, we also want you to really identify with our protagonists, you know? So it's not an either or. Like, we want you to care about and understand all the characters, but we want you to care the most about our protagonist.
Yeah.
You know, and like, then the movie is experienced through her point of view and her journey, you know, like, and very careful decisions were made about camera and all the kinds of things, like lenses, like the aesthetic choices we made were based on the idea that we want the audience to be with Sandra, you know, and she's basically in every scene, you know, so you're really like on this journey with her, and it is a privileged position with her. But at the same time, we want you to see that the other characters are leading complex lives, that they're not, you know, they are not archetypes in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have another just like production question, and then we ask some spoiler questions at the end and give a spoiler warning, because I'd love Absolutely. To talk about the ending. So before we get to spoiler stuff, the setting of this story is incredible. First of all, I was going to mention you're a cinematographer, because there's some of these just enormously wide shots, seeing the valley she's driving through, and it's so gorgeous. But I was curious specifically about how you selected her home, because it's a really beautiful home. But it's also like the way it's set up with her bed upstairs and these huge windows. She's very kind of vulnerable. And so I remember the first time watching it, just having this sense of like anything could happen at any moment. These huge windows, she's so exposed there. What choices went into the actual home she lives in?
You know, you're really asking like these are just knockout questions, because location scouting is the make or break moment in prep, in my opinion. Because, you know, yes, you have, we filmed the movie in Montana, and Montana is one of the most gorgeous areas of the world that I've ever been to. And so like the landscape is all there, like and it's very important to me, and pretty much everything I've done, like this is something I think about, is I'm trying to tap into a kind of a bigger, almost mythic kind of feeling than just the simple action of the story. Like, I would like there to be a part of your brain that's going, this is somehow more fundamental. You know, I do think about things as fairy tales or mythology or whatever, but I really think what it is, it's kind of just existential. Like, I want the audience to be considering some of the big questions when they watch the movie. And I think the way you do that is you put a tiny human being in a giant landscape. Because the moment you do that, then you're like, oh, right, this is the proper relationship. Like, this is the importance of our lives. They're actually extremely inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, and yet they're so important to us. So that was a big reason why I think it had to be a big outdoor movie. And then within that, it's like, okay, how do I get that fairy tale quality in the locations, you know? And so I was thinking about things like, you know, you have the farmer's cottage at the edge of the Black Forest or whatever, like in a Grimm's fairy tale.
Yeah.
You know, like it has to have that kind of clarity. Like, it's the only house in the world, you know, like there's a long road that leads up to it. There's a house at the end of it. And then behind that, it's the wilderness, you know? And it turns out that's actually quite hard to find, especially in Montana. I mean, Montana has so many beautiful houses, but that quality of house, we found that house about a week and a half before we needed to start shooting there.
Oh, wow.
I'm convinced that we had one of our co-producers, Colin Scott, who is from Montana and was very familiar with the area. I believe he drove down every road within a 50-mile radius of Livingston, Montana, trying to find like what I was hoping we would be able to find. And we kept looking at these houses, and they didn't have that kind of mythic quality, you know? And that house, I kind of had to put my foot down about it. Everyone was freaking out because we didn't have this house and we had to shoot there like momentarily, but we just kind of kept looking. And then Colin came into the production office one day and was like, I think we should go out I think there might be one more option, you know, and we drove out there with our fingers and toes crossed the whole way, you know. And when we got out, it's very clear, like, oh yeah, like this is it. You know, you just kind of know if you're, and of course it was a huge pain to shoot there because it's way out in the middle of nowhere. It's totally exposed on that side of this mountain. It's tiny inside. There's nowhere to put anything, no equipment or, you know, very inconvenient. But when you find the place, you kind of have to go with it, you know? And yeah, that house was, I mean, the kind of sense of, you know, this is the feeling she has, is that she loves this landscape. Like, it makes her feel free in a way that she has not felt free in so many ways. And yet it's also very exposed. She is really on her own. She kind of has to handle anything that comes up in this landscape on her own, you know? And anybody who's lived in a place like that, I grew up in rural New Hampshire, you know, but anyone who's lived in a place like that understands that dynamic where you're just in love with the place and you get so much from it, but it's also like not terribly safe for you if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And that's a really essential dynamic because there is a sense of not being safe that kind of runs through the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just thinking too, like when, so she at one point calls the police and they have some interaction, she goes with him, but then when he kind of pushes back, at some point he's like, there are two police for this 300 square miles and one of them is gone, so like it's me, and that puts into perspective too, like she really is alone out there. And yeah, so that's a great moment too of realization.
Yeah, and that touches on something that was we haven't talked about yet, but you know, the primary genre of this as we were writing it is the Western. You know, I mean, you know, we have all the Western scene types and character types in here, but they're all just a little bit flipped from how they usually are. But there's a sheriff, there's the bandits, there's the homesteader, there's the town with the mayor, there's usually a school teacher, like all these kind of character types that happen in a Western are all in this movie. And we wrote it very much with the Western in mind, but just trying to like reveal how Westerns carry ideology and just kind of flip it a little bit, you know?
Yeah. And it's very kind of modernized in that way. So what you're saying too about like loving this place, but feeling the danger, that kind of reflects her professional life too. And that, some of that I'm getting from the short story, because in the monologue there, it's like you can tell he loves this, the character, the protagonist in the short story loves connecting with students and probably loves his job, but the environment, like the dean's board and all of that has become so challenging to him and to her in a different way in God's Country. And I really love the dynamics of her professional life too, because we get that first scene where she's with her students and you can tell she just lights up as she is in the classroom. But then every scene where she's in a meeting with her coworkers, she feels so alone and she feels so there's so much antagonism. And it's kind of under the surface at first, but it kind of grows as the film goes on. So yeah, I really like that dynamic. And that's a lot of where the political stuff comes in too. So I want, as far as the political side of stuff, I feel like I had more questions, but really I was surprised with, so like identity politics comes up in that setting. But so knowing that you had expanded this, when I read the short story, I was surprised a lot of that actually is there, or at least some of the main things that feel like very 2022 about this film were there from the without spoiling anything. But
it's, you know, the short story was written in 1992, but anyone who's taught in higher education, including James Lee Burke, including me, including both of my parents who were college professors, knows the kind of political shenanigans that just go on in those kinds of like very cloistered environments. It's not just higher education, it's any kind of like deeply ingrained institutional setting. You know, it's very, very hard for things to change. The longer an institution's been around, the harder it is for it to change, you know, as we see on a national level. But, you know, like I grew up with two college professors, you know, as parents, and this was the stuff that they talked about at the dinner table. And like, I knew all their colleagues and like went to their departmental Christmas parties. And like all that stuff is, that's in the film, is really kind of from my experience and also teaching, of course, like, especially in the 21st century, you know, with the sort of the work, the DEI workshops that we have to go to, that that I'm looking around and I'm seeing people really are just kind of clocking in and clocking out for this. You know, they're not really clear how to connect it with like what they're actually doing on a day-to-day basis. And all these kinds of things that are well-meaning, but you know, it's like, it's hard to get the message across, you know? And so again, it was like, we want to express these things without like talking at you about it, you know, like this is what's going on in their lives, in our character's life, you know, and she knows how she feels about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's kind of taking care of herself, you know, like she, like she, I feel like she's someone who believes passionately in the importance of what she's doing as a professor, but the bureaucratic stuff, she can definitely take it or leave it, you know? Yeah. And I think she's someone who does what she's doing for very clear reasons. And she wants to kind of go in, do it and leave and not get too involved with all the other, you know, the horse race kind of departmental politics stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think all my other questions are spoilery. So at this
point, okay, great. Let's do it. Let's do the,
give a spoiler warning. So if you've not watched God's Country, please go see it and then return to the podcast as we talk about the ending. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, so first, now that we're in spoiler territory, one of the things that was so interesting going from the short story to the film is the Gretchen character and that plot line. And like, that's such a different feeling when it's her and Tondiwe Newton in the scene versus the older man in the story. But yet, how did you go about, I mean, you basically, it's very similar. Like I was surprised how close it is to the original story, seeing how much everything else changed, but how did you go about bringing that scene, like the confession scene? Confession is not the right word.
Yeah. I mean, in the short story, the character exists in one scene. And you know, a lot of changes were made, but essentially the dynamic of the student who has been made to feel uncomfortable working for the chair of the department through him basically kind of like in a very kind of gray and unclear sort of way, it just feels like he may be coming on to her and some, you know, he's put her in a very uncomfortable position and she doesn't like it, you know, and she doesn't know how to handle it, especially with the power differential, you know? So she goes to her favorite professor to ask his, well, not really to ask his advice, but just to kind of like, as a friend, share what happened, you know? And she clearly wants to on some level, even though it is very uncomfortable for her to talk about. In the short story, with an older man and a younger, you know, woman, there's a dynamic where, and the short story being so much about the struggle that's happening inside the guy, about the kind of the sort of animal instincts and the higher ideals.
Yeah, that he's very kind of sexually frustrated.
He's
of divorce, you know, so he has these uncomfortable feelings towards her as she's telling us. It's a very complex.
Yeah, and really it's incredibly sort of insightful about how, you know, heterosexual men balance their, you know, desires and their responsibilities, you know, like it's actually kind of a pretty amazing scene in the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's aware of the fact that he's attracted to her and he's also very protective of her and furious at his colleague for putting her in this position. And he's trying to like balance all those things. And, you know, he's kind of an anti-hero in the story, you know? And in our movie, like, I think Shay and I were really excited and challenged and inspired by the idea that it would be a totally different kind of conversation when it's an older woman and a younger woman who are both, in this case, women of color as well, which is a change from the story, too, on both of their accounts. That would be it's a challenge for us as, you know, men writers to kind of write that scene, you know, and we wanted to kind of like explore what it's like when the older woman knows exactly what's going on, doesn't even need it explained to her, you know, and feels so many things because of this younger person who she feels very protective of comes to her with this information and just totally understands like the bind that puts her in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so that was sort of like our challenge in writing that scene. I don't know if that's kind of...
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. All that, I love it. Yeah, and I was just going to say, in that scene too, that scene and then the final scene, Tan Tiwei's performance is so... like, you can see all the things she's feeling, how complex that all is. And like, yeah. I just don't know how many actors can pull that off. But like,
so that was a great example, that scene between Tan Tiwei and Tanea Beatty, who plays Gretchen. That scene was a great example of how their performances were so good that we could take away a lot of dialogue. You know, that scene was a lot longer on the page, but they were so kind of in tune with what was happening that we were doing so much more with just these sort of silences and, you know, the glances they take at each other. And anyway, I you know, that is some of her best work in the whole movie, that scene, in my opinion, because her transition from like not knowing what this conversation is going to be about at all and kind of expecting it to be pleasant and like a break, everything else,
yeah,
to a place of just rage, you know, and like, and it all happens completely under the surface. It's so incredibly subtle. That was kind of one of those moments where like, I just tried to not get in the way of the amazing work that she was doing, you know? And we, you know, that entire scene, which is probably a 3-minute scene or something like that, it's 2 close-ups. It's a wide shot of the table. That's it. That's what we shot. We shot. That's the only thing we did. We did, I think we did 2 takes of the wide shot. We did 4 takes of Tan Tiwei, 4 takes of Gretchen. Tanea. Because, you know, when it's working, when the actors are that engaged and that in touch with each other, you don't need to gussy it up with all kinds of junk, you know, just let it be, you know. So I'm really proud of how that scene turned out.
Yeah, Tanea is so amazing in that scene too, and just how uncomfortable and like the words are just like barely coming out. It's a really great scene.
Well, the thing that makes it so torturous is you already know, like, before anybody says anything. And so what we realized was they don't really need to say anything. Like, once you get a sense of what it is, you don't actually need to have her explain anything. So we ended up trimming that scene and letting it play much more as looks than as dialogue.
Well, one other, now that we're in spoiler territory, thing to ask is the backstory for Sandra's character having to do with Hurricane Katrina. But that came out of left field for me when I was watching it. I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. And now we really have a much more full picture of her. But what is amazing is that there's these cut scenes throughout the beginning where we see this rushing water and we don't really understand what's going on until we have that context. And so then we see that again just a few minutes later. Rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is amazing. Because she goes home, sits down, and it's like now she can finally reckon. And now we have this other flashback and now we understand. But it also, it's shot in this kind of red light, so it looks like blood and it feels very ominous throughout the whole thing. And then we get to that scene and we understand what we're seeing, and then we see her photos floating. So now that I'm just like gushing about how much I loved that aspect of the film, but how did you decide to bring that in? Was that, you know, an aha moment as you were writing that you realized we could connect it to this, or how did that go?
Well, I mean, thanks for asking about that. That definitely is something we created out of essentially whole cloth for the feature. It's not in the short story at all. There really isn't much backstory about the main character in the short story. But first of all, you know, when you change the character from a 70-something white guy to a 40-something black woman, as I said, everything else has to change too. You can't just like flip the gender and the race and suddenly be like, you know, we're done. And so we really had to ask ourselves, like, why is this woman here? Like, where did she come from? Like, it's funny how much work we did and how many different versions of the character we explored before, you know, landing where we landed. We had all kinds of backstories as we worked on the script for a year and a half or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially it came from wanting to connect her with American history, like her personal story. That is the connection part that we were talking about earlier, is like we wanted her personal story as a human to touch on some of the major events that have happened in history. And, you know, I mean, Shay describes Hurricane Katrina as like the Black 9/11, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Shay was actually part of the relief efforts after Hurricane Katrina. So he saw a whole bunch of things during that, you know, I think really affected him. And when I learn that kind of information, that like he experienced that himself, he wasn't there during the hurricane, but like he participated in the relief efforts. When I hear that kind of thing from a collaborator, I want to bring that into the movie, because that's so much valuable experience that can really shed light on this, on what we're doing. And so I kind of encouraged him to like, let's see if we can make something with that. And then I realized that, like, of course, it's a huge hat tip to James Lee Burke and his whole body of work. I mean, the main series that he's known for is the Dave Robichaux detective series, which is set in, you know, New Iberia Parish outside of New Orleans. And Jim lived in New Orleans, and like a lot of his work is about New Orleans. And, you know, he wrote an incredible novel called Tin Roof Blowdown that's set during Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath. So like we both, Shay and I, read that novel, and like, you know, we tried to basically combine Shay's experience, the things that have informed James Lee Burke's work, and also like, you know, just sort of apply it to what we were trying to do with the character. Yeah. The red like cutscenes you were talking about with the water were in the script from the beginning, but it was very hard for me to communicate like what I actually wanted to see. Hmm. It never really made sense to anybody. But, you know, and I'm not sure it even made sense to me initially, but slowly kind of figuring out what we wanted to actually see on screen. And then of course, along the way, I kind of, you know, I connected the water and the flooding with the sort of like emotional flooding, like mm-hmm. sort of the water imagery often goes with a kind of sense of overflowing emotion, or like mm-hmm. repressed emotion, you know, that's finally, you know, surfaces. And so that all kind of made sense on a lot of different levels to me. Yeah. So we just kind of went with
it. Dam bursting, you know, in a sense. Yeah. I think it is great. Even when I didn't understand it the first time watching it, I think it was part of this, okay, it feels like we're going towards something maybe not good, and it's part of that feeling, you know. And so yeah. I didn't question it. I was like, oh, maybe we'll never have an explanation, but it's part of that feeling. And then of course it's tied in great.
I'm so happy you said that, because that really is that's how I like movies to work. Mm. I like to feel like when I'm watching something that it is going somewhere, what I'm seeing is very intentional, and that I don't necessarily need to know intellectually what's happening. Hmm. I just want to feel that it makes sense. Hmm. You know, I love when a movie is able to make me feel exactly what it's about and what it's talking about and never say it. That's like my favorite experience as a movie watcher. And that's what we were trying to do with this. And by the way, not everyone loves that. I mean, I'm glad you do, but like some people really don't like the way this kind of the Katrina backstory comes out. I think for some people it does feel abrupt. You know, we were also kind of experimenting in this movie with like, how long can we withhold information and like keep you curious? Like our goal was that you would, by the time you found out a piece of information, you kind of already felt it on some mm-hmm. level, you know? So then you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, yeah. Like another spoiler, like the fact that she used to be a police officer, right. Mm-hmm. Like that is concealed all the way from the very beginning. Like she's acting like a police officer all the way through the movie. And, you know, but when you find that out, you might go, oh, I was not expecting that. But then, you know, the clues have been there from the beginning. So So I don't know whether that's us not doing it properly or just a taste thing. I don't know, but that was our experiment.
I like that it provides also this sort of relief or like contrast between her and the sheriff, because he, you know, she says, well, I had to quit. And he's like, well, he assumes that the worst thing that could have happened is that she had to kill somebody. He's like, that's the worst thing you can imagine. And then it's like, no, I was serving my community and they were abandoned. And like that, the emotional layers of that, for that reason, like I think it did kind of come out of left field a little bit, the Katrina aspect of everything, because Katrina's New Orleans is a million miles away from what's happening in this film.
Yeah.
And when she explains the layers of emotion. Yeah, go ahead.
And frankly, a lot of people have forgotten about Katrina.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Black people have not forgotten about Katrina, but you know, people that were not affected by it were able to and privileged enough to forget it. Yeah. And so I like that we don't actually say that it's Katrina in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, if you know, you know. And if you don't, I love that it makes you aware that there's something you don't know. Like that to me feels important as well. And I love like what you're talking about, the sheriff and Sandra not really being able to reach each other in that scene. That scene was the scene we worked on the most. That was the scene we rewrote the most in the whole film, because trying to make it so that they're both grown-ups, like they get what's happening between them at that moment, instead of it being an argument or some kind of fight or explosive thing or whatever, like it's a big reveal of the backstory. It kind of comes very naturally out of an almost somewhat pleasant encounter they're having. Mm-hmm. But it's because he can't imagine a situation like that happening in his life. Mm-hmm. And it's something she lives with every day. Like it is right under the surface at all times. And that difference between them is essentially that's the whole ballgame. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a perfect like for a white viewer like myself to check your privilege, because like he's never even consider these things that like you were saying, but it also connects back to, you know, we are all a product of our histories, and it's important to recognize that about yourself too. So anyway, I like that aspect of it a lot. Two more things before we wrap up, and one is something I mentioned in person when we were at Bentonville. Like, oh, I want to talk about the religious themes of this. First of all, the title of the short story, when I saw in the credits it's based on a short story called Winter Light, I immediately lit up, because that's one of my favorite movies ever, the Ingmar Bergman film Winter Light. And so I wonder, even apart from your short or your feature, do you feel a connective tissue between the short story and the Bergman film at all, or is that something you care about beyond the name? Or I have a theory of my own after, you know, reading the story and kind of doing it, but I want to hear if you have anything to say.
Well, it's fascinating that you asked that, because I also triangulate Paul Schrader's film First Reformed into this as well, because like First Reformed seems very relevant to Winter Light as well. The Bergman film, not the short story. I didn't put my finger on like, okay, this I'm going to allude to the Bergman film in this movie or anything like that.
Okay.
I don't tend to do kind of like referential stuff like that, you know, or like quoting movies or trying to, you know, for the film buffs, like connect the dots between movies. I mean, I'm happy to have other people do that, but that's kind of not really how I approach making something. But obviously there is a element running through all three of the movies. If I'm so bold as to place my movie with Bergman and Schrader, but, you know, which is a person who is a person of strong faith, whose belief system collapses in a way that they can't figure out how to handle, you know? And that's really what it is for me, is like value systems and belief systems that are being challenged and split apart. I think the thing that we were really like, where we were coming from with it was that we felt at the beginning of 2017 and after the Trump election and of course subsequently, like all kinds of norms and value systems and belief systems were being tested and not holding, you know, but like stuff was falling apart in ways that we had not experienced, you know, kind of to a degree that we had not experienced before. And yet it's also not surprising that that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's what happens. Yeah. As we collect more information, the belief systems get tested. So we, you know, obviously the title of the film is trying to make you think about that. But also like there's a lot of references to the church that she grew up in, and a critical scene takes place in a church. Like we are definitely including religion in the set of dynamics that we wanted to talk about.
Yeah. I love that. And that was where I was going to go next is the church scene. So there's a couple of shots in the movie.
Can you talk about your Winter Light?
Yes. Thing? Yeah. Well, sure. Yes. So basically what you were saying, so it's pretty tangential, but like, Winter Light is a movie about this pastor who's lost his faith, and by the end of the movie, there's something like hope that he will recover a life of faith, or maybe it's faith in God, maybe it's faith in people. It's an ambiguous ending that I really like, but it's like we start the movie and he's entrenched in this lifestyle and he doesn't know, he doesn't believe in anymore, and what do you do with that? And so I think in the short story, we similarly have a person who, you know, he's many years divorced, doesn't have a great relationship with his kids, and he is in a place and he doesn't have any faith in his colleagues anymore. And also like has problems with these hunters, and it just seems like his own view of how life should be is kind of falling apart.
Yeah.
But at the end, which I want to talk about, and then the ending of your movie being different is kind of blows this up. But in the end of the story and the end of the short film, he is digging a grave for this deer, and the men are coming, and in all three, the story, your short, and the feature, we have, they say, we're here. And so like my take on the ending and that line in particular is, you know, the world's an ugly place, the perpetrators are here, like they're going to be here. But the act of burying this deer is sort of symbolic of, and that's why, like you were saying earlier about the fairy tale nature, it feels almost like a fable in some way, that he can try to do the right thing. He can try to be better and change, even knowing that he's doomed. Like it's going to be his doom, but he can be a better man. Or in the case of Sandra, she can try to do the right thing. So with the ending of God's Country, that is more complicated, because I like that we open with this scene of her telling, or not in the very opening, but near the beginning, talking to her class about like, when you see the problems in society, this is the moment that you need to get started. Here's like, it's just this very hopeful and energizing talk that she's giving. And then that ending where the perpetrators have not bettered themselves and they're here burning her house down. She's trying to do the right thing in this moment. And then the final scene where she murders them. So it in a way, and maybe I'm misreading the ending, but it feels like not the most hopeful ending, that you know, she wants people to be better and things to be better, and has this belief, and then it's sort of is crushed by the end where she becomes the killer at the ending.
Yeah, I mean, you did such a good job kind of going through the whole thing. I mean, I when we had our Q&A after the premiere at Sundance, that was the first question was about the ending. And I declined to answer the question because I do on some level feel like it's really not, you don't need to know what I'm trying to say. And frankly, I don't know that Shay and I, we like the fact that it's very challenging, you know, like we didn't want there to be a pat, you know, tidy, resolved ending. I mean, we also conceived the movie along the lines of a kind of great tragedy, you know, like we see it as a tragedy. And you know, the short story ends when he's in the midst of burying the deer and the hunters show up at the house, and you don't know what they're going to do. But the last line is the hunter yelling to someone else, "We're here," like, which takes on a sort of symbolic quality. And that's it. And I actually thought my copy of the short story had been misprinted when I finished it, because it was such an abrupt ending. I was like flipping the pages trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
But the point is that this, like, structurally, the character makes the good and moral choice, which is you know, because the character in the short story and in the feature has the instinct to go punish the hunters. And so, like, Sandra goes to the bar with the gun in her pocket, wanting to take vengeance on them. And when she gets there, sort of fortunately for her, she is able to kind of intervene with her own intentions. Like, her superego comes into play right there. And she's able to stop herself from doing something that she would regard as deeply immoral, unethical. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't want to be that person. So we see her making the correct choice there, the correct, in air quotes, right, choice. Yeah. And then she comes up with an alternative, which is to take this thing that they are not entitled to and return it to the place that it belongs and, like, give this deer a burial, which is, you know, it's kind of like a bit of a wild thing to do. Like, you know, yeah. She's in a heightened place emotionally anyway. It kind of makes sense to her. And I think on some level, hopefully it makes sense to the audience, like, at least what the instinct is. Yeah. And so we see her doing that. And I like the idea that there might be a thought that in people's minds that that could be the end of the movie, you know, that she made the right choice. And now she's, you know, we're going to get a nice little denouement and that's it. But honestly, that didn't feel honest to us as we were writing it, that after all of this and just looking around, it didn't feel honest to us that that could be the ending, you know? And for various reasons, the movie, you know, we decided the movie should continue and keep playing out after that moment when the short story ends. And I think what I'll say about it is, like, I was thinking a lot about grief in the making of the movie. And we introduced the concept of Sandra's mother has recently died to kind of explicitly get into this idea of grief, because it felt like a time when we were sad and grieving, yeah. like for the kind of belief systems and norms that had sort of kept us afloat that were just falling apart. And it still feels that way to me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're living with an enormous amount of grief right now with the pandemic and, like, all the sort of denial of everything that's happening in the world right now. And so what I thought was a way of accessing that idea of tragedy was to sort of see the stages of grief play out across the movie. And mm-hmm. the ending to me is her reaching acceptance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a dark thought to have, but yeah. that's the, like, I think she has seen the truth and has acted accordingly.
Yeah. I love that. And so the other thing, and you mentioned this at Bentonville, as people were asking about the ending, is just that it's a shocking ending. First of all, it's this beautiful long shot, and watching it again, I was like, oh, that started even earlier than I thought. And the camera swivels around and then it just presses in. It reminded me of, No Country for Old Men. There's a great shot of a door that's very important in a tense scene. But anyway, that scene plays out great, and it's brutal. Even though you don't see it, you hear it. I think the point that, because it feels transgressive on some level, like she's doing the wrong thing. I don't know if you said it or someone in the audience said it. Like, you know, if this was John Wayne, a cowboy white guy walking in, getting the bad guys, we would cheer. But because, like, what is it about the fact that it's this older black woman that we feel very uncomfortable with the ending? And that's another kind of galvanizing, or like, it kind of pokes the audience a little bit. And I really like that about the ending too.
Well, I mean, some of the most satisfied reactions we've gotten to the movie, it will come as no surprise to you, are from black women.
Yeah, wow.
Because really, you know, that is one of the most radical choices that we could make, to be honest, because, you know, that's not allowed in American storytelling or American life. You know, it's just not allowed. And we all know that because we all understand how this is supposed to work, whether we resist it or not, we all get it. And so the fact that that happens is truly shocking to a lot of people, I think, in a very good way. Just because this is what art can do, is allow you to go somewhere that you're not supposed to go, you know, and, like, see what that's like, you know.
Yeah.
And the function of tragedy is to kind of acknowledge the things that we don't want to admit to ourselves, mm-hmm. like, you know, and have a kind of cathartic experience of just going to the place that feels like really maybe it's going to be bad, and just like find out what that feels like in a safe space. That's the point of making a tragedy. That's what the Greeks were saying, you know, is to like have this cathartic experience as a community, which, you know, is another reason why I think it's very powerful and a very different experience to see this with an audience than to watch it at home. And that's not just a plug to see it in a theater. Yeah. Of course you should do that. Yes. But like, it is really kind of amazing to watch it with an audience, because you feel those things happening in the audience too. Like, we had one screening where some people in the audience cheered and clapped, and some people in the audience were shocked and gasping. And then they started talking to each other. Like, someone was like, don't clap for that. You know, like, it was fascinating, you know? So it's really that lets me know that it's working. I mean, even if we've had some people who like stay to the end of the movie and then walk out a little bit huffy, you know, like they're mad that we kind of took them there, you know, but they stayed the whole time. So that's, I'm pleased about that. But yeah, it's not an ending that, it's supposed to leave you with a lot to chew on, and hopefully it rewards a second viewing as you understand better like how the kind of the ratcheting took place up to that point, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really like the ending of this movie. The only other thing I was going to mention earlier when we're talking about religious stuff, I jumped ahead actually. But yeah, the scene of the church, when I was going to say first, there's a couple of shots in the movie that I really love where the camera kind of swoops over a hill and reveals something. One later is the tragedy that her dog is dead. But then the first one, you can feel that it's leading up to something, is driving over these hills, and then, oh my goodness, it's a church. And that's where Nathan is going with his mother. And so that's such a shocking just reveal of that. But then they go in and they have this beautiful conversation where they feel like they're actually connecting as humans. And I love it too, because so I've actually done some stuff on this podcast about like being a person of faith, losing faith, and kind of growing up in very kind of strict faith and untangling that as you grow up. And so this movie really played into that kind of stuff that I really enjoyed, because he says something, do you believe in this stuff? And she says, I used to. And then they both have a familiarity of like, I'm here for my mother. And so I just wondered, as you crafted that scene, and that's also the scene where he says, and I love that it's Nathan that has this line. It's like, maybe we're just a combination of our histories. Or I said that wrong, but that's the idea that connecting back to the histories that we can't escape. But yeah, how did that scene come together in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, the line, I wonder sometimes how much you choose to be the person you are. Is kind of like as close as we get to the statement of the question of the movie, you know. And you know, I am an atheist, and Shay, I don't want to speak for at all, but I know he was raised in a you know, religious community in the South, in Atlanta. He was raised in the Black church, essentially, and a lot of his experiences in the movie, obviously. And I think he has a somewhat conflicted feeling about it, but we spent a lot of time talking about all these things about, you know, I mean, we wanted to kind of share with each other everything that we thought could go into the movie from our lives, because that's what this is really about. It's like, this is how making art is how artists process what's going on with them, you know? And, so I have never had like a strong identification with any kind of religious faith or tradition or anything, and I haven't felt it as a void in my life either.
Sure.
But you know, there is something that happens when you go into, you know, a place of worship, no matter who you are, where, you know, your behavior changes a little bit, like everyone gets a little bit quieter, and everyone sort of like knows that this is a very special place for other people. And
when Nathan drops an F-bomb in there, it's like, oh, why do you
yeah, if you're a decent human being, like, you know, who's not a complete selfish, you know, twit, then yeah, you behave a little bit differently in the places that other people hold sacred, you know. And there's something that happens in that church scene that is hard to put your finger on, but what we were hoping was that there's something about the nature of the place that allows this conversation to happen, even though neither of them are really, you know, religious people. You know, and so that is an extremely tricky scene to make work. And I had workshopped it quite a bit with actors before we ever made the movie. And then also, you know, we were using that scene as an audition scene for the Hunter character. So we were seeing that scene a lot. And I got a lot of opportunity to think about how it would work. And like, it's one of those things where like, it just wasn't going to work until we were in a church with the other people there, with the minister doing the sermon, you know, like in the middle of Montana. Like, it just wasn't going to work until all the pieces were there, you know? And as far as conceiving the scene, I thought that it was important to have a scene where we'd conceived a section kind of in the script where she goes into their world and like understands more about how their lives go, like, it, you know, which is felt really important to us that she would have that experience to kind of, and then it's felt like it would be a really a missed opportunity if we didn't give them a chance to kind of have a moment together. And it felt really important to me. I had learned in my AFI first year project, like we did, you know, my third cycle film in the first year at AFI, I had done a kind of doomed love story. And as part of that project, I realized something really important as a storyteller, which is in order to understand a loss or a tragedy, you have to see what was lost, you know? So like in that movie, it was important that you see that these people are really perfect for each other before they can't end up together. Yeah. There has to be a moment where you see this beautiful relationship that could happen in order to feel the loss when it doesn't happen. And so for this movie, it was like, there has to be a moment like that. And it felt like that church scene could be that moment where you see that these people actually have, like, if they just redraw this Venn diagram so that they're within the circle that is labeled human beings, that they actually have so much shared experience, you know? And yes, they've certainly lived very different lives, but they have so much shared experience just as fellow humans on the journey, you know, that they could actually bridge the divides if they wanted to, if they really wanted to. They could actually see each other, respect each other, hear each other. They could even conceivably like go get a beer together, you know? And that seemed like an important thing to see. And then the idea was that he's unable to really cross the bridge because of what he's inherited. You know, so and they're both bringing to bear like their parents, their mothers, you know.
Yeah.
But his mother is literally in that same space with him. Mm. And that's the thing that he can't cross the divide because of the sort of split dynamics there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's what Ta-Nehisi Coates calls the bloody heirloom. I really love that term that he uses, and like he's unable to reach her or like admit that he can relate to her because of what he's inherited against his will.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing too, that I like about the film is that it's never overtly stated, you know, who he voted for, how he feels about people of different races. Like none of that's overt, but you get a sense of, you know, the environment he lives in and, yeah, I like all of that.
Yeah, I mean, those are the things. Those are the things like I was talking about. Like, those are the indicators. Like if certain terms that people use for each other, like they carry an indication for the audience of like, oh, that's what you're supposed to think about that person. And so we deliberately left out all those references because we just wanted it to be deeper than that. Like the point is not to polarize people more. The point is to challenge people out of their comfortable polarization and make them really consider what we're all dealing with all the time. This is not something, you know, white supremacy is not something that only affects people who aren't white. It's terrible for white people. You know, like it's terrible for literally everyone. So I mean, this is the thing, is like I know for me and I know for Shay, and I think for so many people that we worked with on this team, like we actually, the reason we cared about the project is because we actually would like the world to be a better place for people. Like that's really what it boils down to. And part of that, I think, is pointing out what's not working and what is hurting people, like, and getting really clear about it. And not in a way that's easy, but in a way that actually represents how complex it is. I don't know if we did that. And I'm sure there will be people who have different takes on this movie, but that's what we were trying to do.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And thanks for this film. I can't wait for more people to see it and hear other discourse around it as it reaches more audiences. The film is God's Country. And we can wrap
it up. Andrew, thank you so much again. This has been a really awesome conversation. And I just want to say thank you again for just such a close engagement with all of the work. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. This, I mean, getting to dig into stuff and the adaptation of it all, it's my favorite thing in the world. So it's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you to Julian Higgins. My goodness, I really enjoyed talking with him about this film. As you can tell, I think very highly of the film, and I can't wait to see what Julian does next. Next week on the show, the plan is to start a new series on the films of Terrence Malick. I'll be joined by a huge Malick fan named Bethany Worden, who's been on the show once before, and we plan to do 4 films over the next several weeks. Those films are Days of Heaven, The New World, Knight of Cups, and A Hidden Life. So you can watch Days of Heaven in preparation for that next week, which is streaming on Amazon Prime, and I really look forward to that series. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.